And good morning. You're listening to KBOO. It's about 8:03. This is Positively Revolting Talk Radio. I'm Lynn. I'm here with... Who am I here with this morning?
Goodness. I'm almost...
Who are you with this morning,
it's
Lynn?
It's Ani Haynes.
Oh, my goodness. Together in the studio at last, at long last, we are in the same place at the same time.
I love it.
Because I was starting to think maybe we were the same person.
I know. That gets too strange.
I know.
Especially at this hour of the morning. Mm. So we are very happy to be welcoming our guest this morning, who is, oh my God, I'm just going to give a few things. He's got more books and audio tapes than Carter has pills. A really great one is a mythic trilogy. It's The World Behind the World, The Light Inside Dark Times, The Ends of the Dark Time, and The Roots of Eternity. That's great. That's a good one to do. Fate and Destiny, Two Agreements of the Soul. Like I said, if you go to mosaicvoices.org, you can get all kinds of audio sources, and he is all over the YouTube. Please welcome to KBOO back, Michael Mead.
Good morning, Lynn.
Good morning. How are you this morning?
Oh, all right.
We had sunshine for a little bit this morning.
Oh, well, I don't have that here.
Well.
But maybe it'll come the second time around.
Yeah. Which is what you're going to be in town the 14th of April here in Portland and in Olympia, Washington, the 15th, talking about the second adventure of life. And a little quote from you said, the second adventure arises from the inner myth and passionate story set within each soul and the dream that tries to awaken throughout the course of life. What is that about?
Well, I'm using this old idea that there are two arcs or two paths in one's life. And one is the first adventure is just having a life, you know, as they say in modern times, get a life. And so people grow up and they step out and enter the big, you know, drama of the world. And so people rise and fall and win and lose and fall in love and fall out of love and all that stuff happens. And that's necessary. And it isn't, the point isn't that a person succeeds. I don't think that's exactly the point. The point is to be in the great drama and through the winnings and losing, find out who we actually are, who we individually are. And that leads to the second adventure, which is the story that the soul wants to live throughout one's life. And it's often at odds with the first adventure. And so so in a certain way, the idea is to get into the world, win, lose, take it how it comes, learn what a person can learn, and then keep carving out or shaping more time to live the adventure of the soul, which has to do with one's genius, it has to do with one's actual purpose, and it has to do with how a person can meaningfully contribute to the life of the community. And the really sustained life itself.
One of the things I was watching you talk about this, you talked about the difference between parenting and mentoring. I thought listeners might think that was interesting. I certainly did.
Well, the role of the parents is to, first of all, nourish and protect the child, and then support their growth and love them as much as possible. And rarely do the parents know what the true adventure of their children's life is supposed to be. Typically, parents have their own ideas of what the children's careers should be, but the story, the real passion and story of the child is hidden in the soul of the child and is rarely visible to the parents. So it's when the child leaves home or begins to step out into the world that it begins to realize that it has its own, not just its own will and the kind of things they talk about in the modern world, but it has its own dream and it has its own genius. And that usually needs to be recognized, nourished, supported, and protected by mentors as opposed to parents. So parents are about the basic life, in a sense, of the child. Not that parents cannot be brilliant and insightful, but there is some kind of trick in which it's hard for the parents to see where the soul of the child needs to go. And then I call the kind of mentoring I'm most interested in, I call genius-to-genius mentoring, where the genius in a young person tunes in rather immediately to the genius in an older person. That's the classic shape of it. And that mentor person can bless, acknowledge, confirm, support, and help guide the genius and the inner story of a young person entering the world.
And I remember Robert Bly saying that if you didn't, it was a men's retreat that I saw on PBS or something, and he was saying, if you don't, to older men, if you don't appreciate a younger man, you are hurting him.
Yeah, I think that there's truth in that. It goes for women and girls as well.
Right, oh yeah. That goes without saying.
You know what I mean? Because what happens is the family and the home environment can never fully satisfy the child. If the family could satisfy the child, everybody would stay home and we'd all remain children. So there's always something that drives the children out of the house, the greater sense of purpose, and like I say, it's often the dream in their life. And then that needs to be welcomed and blessed. It's the second adventure, but it's also the second birth. It's the birth of the soul. It's the psychological birth of the child, which needs blessing and protection and guidance as well. And so there is some kind of problem in a culture where the older people are not watching and recognizing, inviting, and blessing the young people coming along. Now, the understanding is that each young person is bringing their natural gifts to the world, and if people could understand it, the ones who are on the receiving end of the gifts are those typically who are older. Those who are already in the community are on the receiving end if people understood that each young person is bearing gifts.
Do you think marriage used to be a ritualistic sort of way of going to adulthood in this culture? And I don't think it worked very well. Do we need something a little more structured or... In your workshop, do you talk about this, or?
Well, there's what's missing is what some people call the rite of passage. In other words, natural growth and the developmental process gets a person from infancy to adolescence. You know, the body grows and certain things awaken as the person goes through the stages of development. But there isn't a natural developmental phase that takes a person from being a child to being an awakened adult. That usually, you know, typically, traditionally requires the assistance and the creative intervention of the mentors and those in the culture that are interested in young people finding themselves. And so we don't have it. So what happens is you get all kinds of substitutes and or other parts of life that aren't really structured to do that, like marriage, become the kind of place where those pressures occur. So we're missing something. We're missing two essential things. Well, we're missing a lot more than that. But the two for this morning are this kind of conscious rite of passage that is intended to bring out what's already inside people. So that's the other thing that I'm missing, is an educational process that is focused on the genius that's already in them. Genius is a Latin word, but the word behind it is genie, which is a North African word, and it means the spirit that's already there. And so what's missing in, say, modern education and in also modern cultural practices is the fully realized idea that each young person is a genius in their own way. They are carrying something that's already there from before birth. And one of the main functions of culture, after protecting and feeding its people, is to bring out the inherent genius of each young person, because, and I'm calling that the path of the second adventure, because that makes them more fully realized and also automatically makes them a meaningful contributing member of the community.
It seems like in you know, our culture that lacks this recognition, that lacks this process of initiation, you know, do you think that that's a contributing factor to why so many people just seem lost? So many people seem like they really don't know themselves and are sort of trying to find themselves through any of a number of sublimations like shopping or, you know, that sort of numbing that goes on and is so persistent in the alienation in this culture.
The pictures in magazines or what they've seen on TV mm-hmm. as examples of who to be. Eek!
Well, you can think of it as a major disorientation. So the idea, I think, traditionally would be that a child reaches the verge of youth, the threshold of leaving childhood behind and stepping into this greater adventure. And that's when a serious reorientation is supposed to occur. At first, the child has no choice but to orient to the way the family is structured.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't do that, you don't get fed. So I mean, families can be wonderful and supportive, but the child is still orienting, in a sense, to the shape of the family.
Sure.
From youth on, a person is supposed to be reorienting to what's already inside them. In the modern world, people have come to think that we live in an accidental universe. That's part of the, you know, modern cosmology. And that implies that each person is an accident themselves, that we're accidentally here. And that goes against the much older, much deeper, and I think much more important idea, is that each person has an inner orientation to life. If they mm-hmm. find that orientation, they become not a consumer wandering in the mall of modern, you know, mass goods, but they become an adventurer wandering on the kind of track of their own purpose. And it's a very sad thing to have maturing older people who don't know who they are.
And right, because they can't, how can they, that's the other thing that I've noticed, is like, if you don't know who you are, how can you mentor or help some younger person? Yes.
You can't. The mentors, by definition, would be people, the men, M-E-N, in mentor, has nothing to do with masculinity. It comes from the old Greek word mens, which means wisdom. And it's actually connected to this old goddess of wisdom, who is the figure behind Athena, who is like the Sophia of Greek mythology, the wise woman. And so the mentors are actually those who have somehow found their own orientation and some kind of at least occasional wisdom. And so then it's the young people who sense this oriented life in the mentors, and it works best. Mentoring, in my experience, works best when it's the young people picking their mentors, because they will unerringly pick someone with a similar genius to themselves.
Oh, that is fat. Yeah. I just want to remind our listeners, this is KBOO. You're listening to Positively Revolting Talk Radio with Ani and Lynn, and we have Michael Mead as our guest today. If you have a question for Michael Mead or comment, give us a call at 503-231-8187 or send us an email at positivelyrevolting@gmail.com. One of the things, too, that goes with that you were talking about was genius versus ego.
So if you imagine that the genius is spirit that's already there, that's the origin meaning of the word. So the each child comes into the world with a spirit, with a quality in their soul, a gifted quality that is oriented a certain way and aimed a certain way. But like I said, the family can't attune to that. It's not even supposed to at first. It's supposed to just protect that kind of delicate life. But what happens in the course of development very early on is some shocking little thing occurs through which the infant realizes, whoa, I'm not really going to get everything I need all the time. And mom, even if she's doing a good job, can't hold me the way I need to be held all the time. She may have other children. She may have other tasks to do. And in that moment of some kind of infantile realization, there's a separation from the sense of being in the kind of perfect world, and that's where the ego forms. So the ego, in a sense, forms almost opposite to the genius. It's complicated, but the idea is that the genius can't fully appear until youth, when the child is going to step into their own life and therefore deal with their own inner life. The ego is there as a kind of substitute for the true self. So I'm not against the ego. You know,
you need one to get out of bed in the morning.
Exactly, and it knows where the car keys are.
Hopefully,
on a good day.
Yeah, right.
And so the ego has a function, but what happens later in life, the ego can get in the way of this second adventure or the dream of one's life. So one way to think about it is that the ego and its shaping is a necessary thing for survival early on. Later on, the ego has to loosen and open up and leave more room for the inner life to come through. So that as people get older, they're supposed to have a looser, more flexible, more open ego. In other words, they're not supposed to turn out to be Donald Trump.
And I was going to say, certainly we can see what happens in situations where people don't loosen up. And you know, it strikes me that when one finds that a construct in their personality, that a way of looking at the world hasn't served them or doesn't serve them as they've tried it out and are assimilating their experience, this is one of the processes of opening up the ego. It's the looking at those parts of your personality that you formed that really don't serve you, that were maybe constructed in reaction.
Exactly.
I was just talking with someone about that the other day, about how you have archetypes when you're young that serve you. We should probably explain archetypes. That would be a good idea to do. But then how to sort of consciously change them as you get older to things that serve you better.
Well, mythologically, you know, in terms of stories and mythology, the world itself is trying to help change and expand the kind of true spirit of one's life. In other words, when I talk about fate and destiny, fate being often those things that fall upon us, if a person, once they are struck by an element of fate, an accident, a loss, whatever it might be, they are then in position to move closer to their destiny. It doesn't feel that way because it seems like something has gone seriously wrong. But what happens when things go wrong in that way is the ego is stunned, and the kind of unconscious process of one's life is interrupted. And what's going on at a deeper level is the dream of one's life, the true purpose of one's life, is trying to rush through that gap. And in fairy tales and myths, the forces of the other world, which can be, the gnomes and the animals that turn out that they can speak, and even the old hags, which people are afraid of, are actually trying to help a person awaken to who they are in the essence of themselves. And so, again, with a culture that's aimed so much at the outside world, most people do not trust what's inside. And most people wind up living an alienated life. And it's getting worse. And you can see it by who gets elected on one level. There is a political result in the sense that people keep electing people who have no idea who they are and who pretend to be all kinds of things that they aren't. And it's almost like a shadow play version of what's happening inside individual lives.
And that also in that shadow play, I think that there's something to be said when Lynn was mentioning a moment ago about flipping through and looking at the pictures of magazines to check out and see how your life is supposed to look. It strikes me that we are so idolatrous of the celebrity in this culture that we often, it seems like and there's a good segment of our society that lives vicariously, you know, through folks that, well, we don't know really anything about, but there they are in the pages of the magazines, and they are, for whatever reason, our culture's heroes.
Well, there's something there that's inevitable, and then there's something there that's become extremely distorted. The inevitable part is that everybody has to project their life onto others. It's the basic psychological move is I can't simply see what's in myself. That's that the ego's in the way, fear is in the way, all kinds of things. So I project what's in me onto others in order to get a sighting of it, in order to orient to who I want to be or what I want to be like. And so that part's, I think, natural. It's one of the basic psychological moves, and it's not going away.
Mm-hmm.
But what I think has become wildly distorted is the idea is that only certain people are worth celebrating. This is the big, you know, mistake, in a sense, of American Idol, even of politics. It's the idea that there are special people out there, and they're often called stars. And that's not an accident, because the word destinari, destiny, Latin, it comes from Latin, destinari, means of the stars. That is to say, each person is secretly tied to a destiny written in the world of the stars, in the big world. And since people don't know that, but we have to project, people begin to project the importance of life onto other people and celebrate those people who pretty quickly deteriorate because of the excess attention they're getting. In the meantime, people are forgetting it's our own lives that we're here to awaken to and celebrate. And community is made not from avoiding all that stuff, I don't think, but what is really the essence of community is when people are recognizing, accepting, supporting, and blessing that which is worth celebrating in each other.
Yeah. Yeah.
So say we all.
So say we all. How about a phone call, Michael? You want to take a question from a listener?
Sure.
Okay. I believe Pat's on the line.
Good morning.
Good morning. Have you got a question for Michael?
Well, at the risk of sounding like an antagonist here, I have a problem with the, you know, the crown of creation, if you remember that old rock and roll song, the thinking that Homo sapien is so doggone special. Whereas I don't believe the universe is accidental, but I'm a firm believer in the paradox of ultimate chaos and ultimate order and structure simultaneously. You know, like nature is ultimately chaotic, but at the same time, it's perfectly structured to support itself. And we are, of course, part of nature, whether we act in congruence with our systems that keep us alive. You know, whether we act with those or not, we are still part of nature. And, you know, I just have a problem where Homo sapiens thinks that he is the crown of creation. And I'll listen to your response off the air. Thank you.
Okay, thanks.
Of course, I have to go a different way, because I come from mythology, not from the social sciences or the so-called hard sciences. And in mythology, you can find many different stories. Most of them are placing humans in the center. And I know this is disturbing in terms of modern thought. But for instance, the Popol Vuh, which is the Mayan creation myth, describes how the world was created and all the trees and the mountains and the land and the rivers and all the animals and all the birds were made. And they were created. And the gods who made them were celebrating the beauty of this thing. But they noticed that there was something missing. And so they tried to figure out what was missing, and they came up with two things that were missing. A creature that knows, that consciously knows that this is a created world that's beautiful. And second of all, some creature that feels gratitude for the gift of life. And it was in order to fill in those two things, a conscious presence that recognizes the beauty, the wonder, the mystery, the chaos, and the order of this thing, and then secondarily can feel gratitude. Now, gratitude is an important thing because psychologically they say you can only feel gratitude when you are in a moment of wholeness. So that humans represent this capacity to be whole and when whole in the middle of creation. Now, when the humans are being greedy, when the humans are being foolish and exploiting the earth and so on, they're not in the center. They're barely on the edge of creation. But when a person is in touch with the center of themselves, they are also in touch with the center of the cosmos. That's the understanding of humans in the middle. my feeling at this point is if more people don't find the wholeness in themselves and learn how to live more fully into that wholeness, then the world is in greater danger than it needs to be. And unfortunately, humans now have the power to, you know, make mass destruction. And so this issue of where the human soul is becomes more important. And just since I've gone down this road, from my own point of view, this idea that says that Homo sapiens are expendable from the point of view of nature is a complete misunderstanding of how indelibly humans are woven into the core mystery of nature. And nature is a mystery, not a practicality.
I want to remind listeners that it's 8:30 in the morning. You are tuned to Positively Revolting. This is Ani. I'm here with Lynn, and we are delighted to have on the line Michael Mead, an author, a mythmaker, a storyteller extraordinaire. And Michael will be in Portland, and that is coming up. Lynn has details in front of her.
Is going to be April 14th at the First Unitarian Church, which is 1211 Southwest Main Street at 7. You can get tickets at mosaicvoices.org or I'm sure at the door. And he's going to be in Olympia on April 15th. And they're going to have a creative mentoring workshop Saturday the 16th from 9:30 to 5:30 at the Olympian Unitarian Universalist Congregation. Bless those Unitarians. They are good for spaces, aren't they, Michael?
They're good.
And we do have a call-in line if you would like to come on in with your questions, your comments, 503-231-8187. This morning is the number to join us, just like Pat did. You know, turning away for a moment from the deeply personal into an expansion of our place on this planet, our place in this world, that connection when we're truly centered and in touch with ourselves, you know, recognizing that connection, seeing ourselves as whole and part of things. Couldn't agree more, but now here we are in the world that's on fire. I'm looking over the last couple months, and there has been such radical change from revolution to tsunamis to the worst nuclear nightmare that we've seen to date that has no end in sight. What can we do to try to incorporate this and make sense of this, looking at myth? How can myth help us make sense of our times now, which seem truly epic?
Yeah, I completely agree. We are living in a most unusual time, and part of what is striking, and it's repeatedly striking to me, is you have radical changes in culture, and then at the same time or shortly after, a radical eruption of nature.
Yeah.
You know, so that you can start to get used to the idea of, wow, revolution in the Middle East, who saw that coming? And then just as you're trying to absorb that, it's, you know, earthquake and tsunami in the Far East. And this has been going on now for a while. I think it's going to continue. I wrote a book called The World Behind the World, where I tried to get at the mythological background of this because we're in a surprising part of history and so on. And so in that book, what I did was collect stories from various cultures of the world, mythological stories, that talk about how the world keeps renewing itself from its own ashes. And the reason I wanted to address that is it's not up to us to save this world. I think the caller right before was on that track, and I agree with that. In other words, nature is going to go through, it's going through something that's going to continue to go through it. But we are contributing to it in ways that are, you know, really terrifying. For instance, of all people in the world, it's surprising that the Japanese would put a nuclear plant in a dangerous place.
I know, it's not even, ironic doesn't even cover it.
It's beyond ironic.
Mm-hmm.
It's as if, you didn't get this message, and I'm sorry to talk this way because I don't want to reduce what's going on in the tragedy of it, but from the mythological level, perhaps, if you didn't get the message from having nuclear weapons dropped on you, maybe you'll get it when it surges up from the bottom of the sea. You know, that this stuff is not to be played with. or not to be played with in some kind of foolish way. But that being the case, or not, we're going through something that is going to continue to seem unbelievable, as people say so often now. The two most popular words these days might be unbelievable and absolutely. people are catching these two opposite winds all the time. But
going together in absolutely unbelievable, actually.
There you go. And then you're there. But then again, there is a mystery behind it all. And that's the part that keeps getting lost. People are trying to nail down something that is by its nature mysterious and creatively capable of altering all the time. So in the book, I was writing about how the word apocalypse doesn't mean, you know, finito, the end, good night, goodbye, lights out. Apocalypse means to lift the veil. And apokalein, it comes from an old Greek word. And we're living in this period of the lifting of the veil. And so you see into, you know, I remember when Enron, which was at one point the biggest corporation in the world, and then when the veil lifted, there was nothing in there. There was nothing there. There was no Enron in Enron. And then you have the you know, lifting of the veil inside the Catholic Church, and it turns out that the people that are supposed to be helping others are actually, some of them, are wounding children and so on. And so we're living through this period where the veil lifts, and you see this fragility of modern technology, these powerful things that everybody thinks they need, the nuclear plants, just get turned upside down practically by the motions of nature, which is so much bigger. So I think we're in that kind of apocalyptic times where things will keep changing there. And I think a lot of people are feeling that now. And one of the results is the feeling of being disoriented. You can't keep up with the changes that are going on. And that's why I've been writing about and talking about this second adventure, this second deeper level of a person, because if the outer world, both culture and nature, continue to rattle the way they are, then where does a person find a sense of deep security and orientation? And I'm suggesting that in the midst of radical change, just like in the midst of an accidental loss, a person either grows bigger or smaller. People are either going to retreat into small lives and keep voting for pretend security, or people are going to say, you know, if this thing is going to rattle and it could end any moment, I think I'm going to step into the life I came here to live, and I'm calling that the second adventure. And when a person is living the life their soul intends from inside, they may, in fact, become more helpful to both the cultural side of things and the natural side of things. That's the kind of secret hope, I guess, that I have.
Have you got a story that goes with that?
Well, the one that's coming to mind in a moment is a story from a myth in South America where the world actually does go on fire and it burns up and everything in the world burns up. And everything's turned to ash, and where there were forests and where there were buildings, it's all ashes, and life is basically destroyed and turned to ash. And then it happened that there were two beings that were in the other world. You know, in mythology, there's another world. I call it the world behind the world. It's the world where everything comes from and everything keeps being created from. Anyway, they were over there. They come back into the ash world, our world, which has been turned to ash. And at one point, they're scrounging for something to eat, and Ikanchu, the main character, hits something hard down in the ash and pulls it up, and it's a charred, charcoal piece of wood. And he holds it there, standing in the ashes of the world, and he recalls that charcoal comes from wood comes from trees, but also drums come from trees. And so he decides, since he can't eat it, maybe he'll play it like a drum. So anyway, he does that, and since he's playing the charcoal like a drum, he might as well dance. As long as he's dancing, he might as well sing. So now he's singing, drumming, and dancing in the ashes of the world, in the terrible thing everybody's so worried about. He's dancing in it. He gets tired, falls asleep, wakes up in the ashes the next morning and sees the piece of charcoal, and out of it is coming this green tendril. and he suddenly realizes what's happening, and he gets up and begins to dance and sing around that piece of charcoal, and as he does so, the tendril grows, and it becomes the trunk of a tree, and the tree branches out, and then the branches produce leaves, and leaves produce flowers, and the flowers produce fruit, and he knocks branches off of it, and that leads to more trees growing out of the ashes, and eventually the whole world grows back from its own ashes, but also from the dancing and singing and staying in the center of life of those human beings, let's say.
Truly lovely, yeah.
So it's talking about, yes, the earth itself is a huge mysterious entity, in a sense, that produces amazing varieties of life and will continue to do so in some way. And our job is, even when it's burnt down to ashes, is to remember that we're still supposed to dance our own dance. We're still supposed to respond to the beauty of creation and possibly even the presence of destruction. It's something like that. It's like saying, don't give up on the world. And personally, what I'm trying to say is, especially for people who are well-intentioned, do not retreat into the false security of staying out of things, but in the midst of the terror, in the midst of the disturbance, find one's natural way of dancing with creation, because nothing else really is kind of secure in a person except our own weird and strange gifted way of being present.
Yeah, and Molly Ivins always said, freedom fighting takes a lot of parties.
Well, yeah. If people
and get beer, but I won't mention that this hour.
Well, you know, I was working with some people doing environmental projects, which are really important. But the environmental projects get in trouble is when they become overly analytic, when they become overly scientific, and so on, because they forget, in a sense, that the basic environment, the natural, most natural environment, is the dance of life.
Mm-hmm.
That when we're oriented, if it's our real work, when we're oriented towards where we can work best, help best, contribute best, we find the dance. I have another story in that book about how, again, there's all this trouble going on, and this one character, it's like our ancestral character, there's a fish in the ocean, and he's walking on the shore, and the fish says, can you pull me out of here? Because if you don't save me, some bigger fish is going to devour me. And so here's this interspecies conversation going on, and the human has a choice. Do I help this other species, or do I pretend it's not my issue? In this case, the fellow picks up the fish and brings it home, gets some kind of a container and puts water in it, and as soon as he feeds the fish, it grows, and it keeps growing and gets bigger and bigger. It outgrows the container, it outgrows the pond, it outgrows the lake, and he realizes he has to get it back to the ocean because it's getting so big, and he picks it up and starts to carry it, and it's huge, but it doesn't weigh anything. It doesn't feel heavy. He can carry it. He brings it back, put it in the ocean. Anyway, it turns out to be the god of creation and so on. But the part that's so interesting to me is it's gotten huge, way bigger than him, but it's not heavy. Why is it not heavy? Because it's the creative work he's supposed to be doing. That's how I interpret that. So that you have people now in positions of power and authority who are not equal to them. We see it all the time, right?
Yeah.
Those are the people running things, typically speaking, and they're making huge mistakes that will affect generations into the future. Something different happens when people pick up the right project, their own life project, and then critical moments occur. And if a person is oriented from the inside themselves to the world, they don't have to know everything. They can kind of be inspired to make a better decision or create something. And I've seen it in people doing ecological projects, and you see it all the time in culture when people are making great art. And so I think our best way to contribute to the healing and the kind of restoring of the world is to be working in the place that our souls are aimed at. In other words, I'm not the best person to send out to try and figure out what's gone wrong in the forest. you know, I grew up in New York City, and I live inside stories. I'm not the best person for that. But I'm better off working with the stories, and trying to help people find their own story. That makes sense to me, and it sometimes is helpful to them. And I think this idea that everybody gets the same education, and then from that educational base, everybody votes for people who pretend to know something, is not going to help at all.
Kind of dangerous.
It's become extremely dangerous.
Yeah.
You know, and now that the world is all interconnected in terms of communications, everybody knows every tragedy right away. There's an old saying
repeatedly,
that,
yeah.
It's the same to live in tragic times as to live in a tragic place. So we cannot help but feel and be troubled by the tragedy in Japan. We cannot help but be disturbed by what's happening in Libya, and so on. And we can't get away from it either. We are caught in this huge kind of disorienting process of change, and at least in my little way, I'm trying to suggest that in the midst of change, the best thing to count on is what is already seated in oneself. But that depends on people knowing that they have something inside themselves. And that is something that often doesn't feel fully present unless it's been recognized and blessed by someone else. And that's what a real teacher is. That's what a real mentor is someone who blesses what's actually there, not someone who teaches what they would like others.
Right, and recognizes it, right.
Yeah, it's a real recognition. So the other thing that's involved in this second adventure is a calling. It used to be called a vocation, which is a fancy name for being called. So in the modern world, people are pretty excited about choices. And you can fool people by saying, well, you have a choice here. But in the mythological level of things, choices aren't the key thing. It's being called to something beyond oneself that's the key thing. So everybody has a calling, and it starts during when something in the world starts to call to someone. Someone picks up a guitar and actually can play it as soon as they touch it. That's because it's part of their giftedness and probably part of their calling. But the way I'm talking about it, a person's calling keeps recalling. It's like we're on speed dial with the other world in the place where we're trying to be called to. And why is that important? To me, it's partially important because the greatest proportion of American culture right now are people over 60. The olders, there are more olders than youngers. In the Middle East, those revolutions that are going on are being led by young people.
Yeah, it's the opposite there.
Yeah, because there's over 60% of the people in, say, Egypt are under 25.
Mm-hmm.
Here, I think it's by now over 50, but over 60 maybe. Anyway, the people over 60 are the largest population group. And so I'm suggesting to people who are getting older that it's like the song you were playing. The whole thing is better the second time around if we listen to what's calling to us. The wealth in this country is also 75% in the hands of people over 60. If the people over 60 would respond more to the second adventure, the true calling in life, they not only would feel more secure, be more creative, and have more joy in life, but they have the wealth to make changes that could benefit everybody else. And so, anyway, that's...
Well, speaking of calling, we've got a caller.
Okay.
Lynn and her segues. That was smooth.
Thank you very much.
Really smooth, darling.
Yvonne is on the line. Have you got a question for Michael?
I do, Michael.
Good morning.
Good morning. Excellent show, Michael.
Thank you.
I think, Michael, the energy that we're feeling in our bodies and our beings this time of world's history is going to be translated into a phenomenal war that will take place in the Middle East, where I see my energies conquering the Muslim radical sect, and when we annihilate that, I think that our energy will bring about peace in the world. And so I'm really feeling the anxiety of the energy of war.
Okay, Yvonne, we're going to go ahead and see what Michael has to say to that.
Well, the danger with that kind of thinking, to me, is that it places the usually what's called evil, the bad intentions, the bad purposes, somewhere far outside oneself. And it's similar to the mistake, perhaps, that some radical Muslims are making. That is, the idea that you could conquer your way to heaven or your way to peace. Peace is a Latin word, pacem, and it means to make agreements. So peace is not a steady state. It's the constant working out of agreements that allows the parts of ourselves and our lives with other peoples to continue. So peace cannot be achieved through war by definition. But the problem, I think, part of the problem, mythologically speaking, why the Middle East is so important, it's really, you could call it the Middle West also. It's the middle between the East and the West. Mm-hmm. And there's this kind of philosophical, mythological collision happening in the Middle East. And it's going to keep happening. I hope it doesn't go to out-and-out war. And personally, I don't think it's going to. But I think what's trying to happen there is something else. And, I mean, it's very complicated, but there's something I want to say about it, which is right in the middle there, Middle East-West, is where in the Western world, paradise was considered to be in the Garden of Eden, actually in Persia, which is now Iran. So in a way, we're fighting over the presence of the Garden of Eden, or the presence of the possibility of everybody being closer to the divine, closer to the kind of magical garden of life. And I'm hoping that that realization starts to dawn more on people. But the danger in the Middle East is not simply radical Islam. It's also radical Christianity, conservative Christianity, and it's also radical capitalism, which has somehow forged a marriage with conservative Christianity, mm-hmm. You know, so that you have people who believe both that the Bible is the literal word of God, but also that the determining factor in the daily life is so-called free trade. That's a very surprising and strange marriage. But at any rate, we have our own fundamentalisms, we have our own shadows, we have our own delusions about how this world should be. And I think the danger in the Middle East is the collision of fundamentalist Christian sensitivity, or lack of sensitivity, with fundamental Islam. And I'm hoping that gets avoided on the basis of more people being a little bit wiser than that and more practical than that.
And to me these days, it seems like fundamental Christianity and American government and the corporations in this country is far more dangerous than whatever the radical Muslims are doing over in the Mideast.
Well, I think it's the same disease, if I could just say it in that way. It's the same delusion. The idea that there's a single way. In the middle of this book, The World Behind the World, I was following mythology, so I had to put in the middle of the book the world tree, because that's what most mythologies have. And in the middle of the Garden of Eden, which is the Western myth, but there's Eastern versions of it, there's actually two trees. One is the what I call the starter tree, which is the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, so that when people are arguing about what's good and what's evil, they're at the beginning of the understanding of life. And then forgotten in many of the myths of paradise, which are both held by Islam and by Christianity, is the central tree is the tree of life. And from the tree of life comes all branches of knowing and all branches of understanding. And when a person is at the beginning of a branch and has or path, hasn't followed it all the way towards the center, All they can see is the differences and the oppositions and the conflict between one path and the other. But where mysticism is extremely practical is it says that when a person gets closer to the center of their own life and therefore of life itself, they suddenly begin to see how all the paths are leading to the same place. So inside something that can become as blind and destructive as whatever we're going to call it, the terrorist branch of Islam. But in that same kind of imaginal structure, you have the Sufis who use the Quran also, but they use it to get to the center. And inside those Sufi poems, they say, you know, you want to be riding in the boat in which Muhammad is telling jokes to Jesus and Moses is cracking up, and there's a few other tricksters in there as well. In other words, I'll go back to my original idea. If a person is closer to the center of themselves, they can move closer to the center of everything. And the closer a person gets to the center, the more they can see that everybody's coming from different paths trying to get to the same place.
Right. You want to try one more call, Michael?
Sure.
I think Alan's on the line. Make it short and sweet.
Thank you. I sure will. Thank you for the show this morning. Thank you for your comments, Michael. I read an article the other day about humor and how, humor sort of opens up all of these, sort of pathways and senses and helps promote community. And even that there was evidence that, ancient peoples employed and had humor in their societies. And like you were saying with the Sufis and stuff and the dancing, sort of this, some sort of a way humor is even mystical. But anyway, I thought I just wanted to inject that into it as well.
Thank you, Alan.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And it's like humor is the positive creative side of the trickster energy, which is always around in some form. And humor is also connected to humus, which means earth. In other words, the very earth we're walking on has a certain amount of humor in it about this whole thing. I mean, to the earth, which is producing trees day and night, has trees growing out of those trees that just died, pops up all kinds of strange forms. This thing has a kind of a hilarious side to it. And then the other word that's connected to humor is humility. And when people see something funny, that's when we realize a little bit of a more humble attitude that we are part of a big mystery that has humorous as well as creative as well as mysterious sides. So yeah, I'm all for humor and the dance without letting go of the idea that there are serious occasions in everyone's life that this should also be hilarious.
And that is where we're going to have to end it. And Michael, I thank you so much. Once again, Michael Mead is going to be here in Portland talking about the second adventure of life, Thursday, April 14th at 7 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church, 1211 Southwest Main. We'll link with your website, which is mosaicvoices.org. And if you want a little trip to Olympia, he'll have a workshop on creative mentoring on April 16th. So thank you so much, Michael.
Well, thank you both. Good to be with you.
Excellent. Thanks.
We look forward to doing it again.
We do, indeed.
Right. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye.
Thank you all for listening to Positively Revolta. I believe is next show...
No. We have a moment before we welcome you to become members. In fact, we always welcome you to become members. You can go to kboo.fm. Even right now, if you realize that you are not a KBOO member yet, you can become one today. There is a membership drive approaching. We call that on April 28th. We will begin our spring membership drive. But Lynn and I will be back in just 2 weeks on the 15th. And until then, encourage you to be positively revolting.